Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is actor Sylvia Sidney. Born Sophia Kossow in 1910, she became Sophia Sidney in 1915 when her parents divorced and she was adopted by her stepfather, a dentist named Sigmund Sidney. Shortly thereafter, Sophia told her mother that she wanted to be known as Sylvia simply because she didn't like her given name. Even as a small child, Sylvia Sidney was determined to forge her own path. She began acting on the stage in 1925, and good notices paved the way for her to go to Hollywood, where she made her screen debut in 1926's The Sorrows of Satan, directed by D.W. Griffith. It didn't take long for Sidney's career to kick into high gear, and in short order, she was holding her own with screen legends like Spencer Tracy, Humphrey Bogart, Frederick March, Joel McRae, Gary Cooper, Henry Fonda, and George Raft. She worked with some of the greatest film directors of all time, appearing in Alfred Hitchcock's Sabotage, Ruben Mamoulian's City Streets, Fritz Lang's Fury, William Wyler's Dead End, and Dorothy Arzner's Merrily We Go to Hell. Unlike other top stars, however, Sidney never really warmed to life in Hollywood, taking numerous chances to return to her native New York and continue theater work. Seemingly unwilling to play the game, Sidney focused on doing interesting roles, not necessarily what was best for her career. During the 1940s and 50s, starring parts grew fewer and fewer. After 1956's Behind the High Wall, a low-budget prison drama, she focused on theater and the new medium of television, not appearing in another film for 17 years. When she did, it was as Joanne Woodward's tough-as-nails mother in Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams, for which she was nominated for her only Academy Award, thanks mostly due to an unforgettable death scene. She lost to Tatum O'Neill, but that kicked off a new phase for Sidney's career in movies. And in between more theater work and TV, she co-starred in Larry Cohen's cult classic God Told Me To, the less classic Damien Omen 2, and I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. In 1988, mega fan Tim Burton approached Sidney to appear in Beetlejuice. Not understanding the script, the Suffer No Fool Sidney turned Burton down three times, at one point literally tossing the strip into the trash. But Burton was not to be deterred, and after meeting with her in person, she agreed to appear as Juno, the taciturn afterlife caseworker for Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin's recently deceased but don't know it Maitland. Sidney continued to work well into her 80s, reteaming with her now beloved director Burton, I believe we were lovers in a past life, Sidney said about him in an interview, for her final film, 1996's Mars Attacks. Her small but vital role as Lucas Haas's grandmother helps ensure that the entire world is saved from a Martian invasion. Not a bad way to end a film career. Joining me to discuss Mars Attacks and the career of Sylvia Sidney is film and culture writer Mariah E. Gates. Hi, Mariah.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being here.
It's always great to be here.
I am really excited to talk about the career of Sylvia Sidney. I learned so much because I think probably like a lot of people my age and younger, our introduction to her really was Beetlejuice. And then, you know, you went back and you go, oh my God, her career goes back all the time, that she did all this amazing work. And there was just so much there that you didn't know about until, you know, you do the research. You see, she worked with all these people, like I detailed and stuff. So I can't wait to talk about Mars Attacks because that was a movie that I loved when it came out and I hadn't seen it really much at all in the intervening years. And then, you know, of course, I had a reason to go back and check it out again for the purposes of this show. But I want to start with you, like, why of all the people to pick? When I asked you to be on the show, why Sylvia Sidney?
Oh, man. I really love Sylvia Sidney. When I used to work at TCM, one of the things I'd always harass Charlie, the lead programmer, about was doing more Sylvia Sidney. And it got to the point where he was LA-based and main TCM is in Atlanta, so he'd only be in Atlanta, you know, a couple times a year. But every time he saw me, it got to the point where he, before I could even say hello, he'd be like, I know. Sydney. And then lo and behold, in 2019, they did a Summer of the Stars, Sylvia Sidney Day. And I'm not saying it happened because I harassed him for 4 years, but I'm not saying that.
Right.
I just think she's really a unique screen presence. I also first came to her in Beetlejuice and Mars Attacks. And when I first saw a movie with her, I'm trying to think what the first classic film with her I saw, but it might have been is it Dead End, the one with Bogart?
Yeah, that's Dead End.
I think that might have been the first one that I saw with her that was like where I was like, wait, is it, this can't be the same person from Mars Attacks. This is the grandma? Like what? And then obviously once I realized that and I started seeking out more, kind of like, I think there's quite a few actors like that who came back kind of in the '80s, like Don Ameche, you know, who was in, I forget the one he won the Oscar for, but I was thinking of Harry and the Hendersons, which he did not win an Oscar for Harry and the Hendersons, but in my heart,
Cocoon? Did he win for Cocoon?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I was like, what? I couldn't remember. But, you know, like Don Ameche, same thing, where he was in that and Trading Places and like all these things. And then you go back to the '30s and you're like, wait a minute. Don Ameche was in like so many movies. I think, Sylvia Sidney's like that, where you, when you go back and watch those 30s films, you see why filmmakers in the '80s were like, can you please be in my movie? She's just very unique. And, one of my favorite quotes is from, James Baldwin, who said that she was the only actor when he was a kid that reminded him of reality. And I think she does bring a grounded presence and a kind of a light presence in her comedies, and a very grounded, real presence in her dramas, and she's just not really like anybody else from this era.
That quote from James Baldwin, I found that I read a book about her biography of her called Paid by the Tear.
Oh, yes. Which, Paid by the Tear.
Yeah,
I read that.
She said that she was paid by the tear. That's that was her quote, and that's why they the title of the book that. But the quote from James Baldwin is really extraordinary, where he says, Sylvia Sidney was the only American film actress who reminded me of a colored girl or woman, which is to say that she was the only American film actress who reminded me of reality. All of the others, without exception, were white. And even when they moved me, like Margaret Sullivan or Betty Davis or Carol Lombard, they moved me from that distance. Some instinct caused me profoundly to distrust the sense of life they projected. This sense of life could certainly never, in any case, be used by me. And while his eye might be on the sparrow, mine had to be on the hawk. My reaction to Sylvia Sidney was certainly due in part to the kind of film she appeared in during that era: Fury, Mary Burns, Fugitive, You and Me, Street Scene. It was almost as though she and I had a secret. She seemed to know something that I knew. That's extraordinary. I mean, that is an extraordinary compliment to come from anyone, let alone James Baldwin.
James, it's really high praise. And I think when you watch her films, you can see exactly what he means. A lot of, and I love the 30s, and I love the heightened performances of 30s actors, but she brings a depth, like a grounded depth to roles that in most other actresses would feel a little stagey or would feel a little artificial. And she never feels artificial. She also was called the ugly kid,
which is
insane. I'm always like, what the hell? Like, were they all wearing like masks when they look at her, or like, cause I don't know, she's beautiful. It's crazy, but I think because people told her she wasn't pretty, and I probably didn't think she was pretty. That's part of, I think she didn't get caught up in being a glamorous, you know, actress. She was creating people. And you feel that when you watch her films from the 30s and 40s.
She doesn't have, and this is not at all a knock in any way, but it's like she doesn't have that kind of, at least in my opinion, from the ones I watched. And then, by the way, you recommended, I asked you, you know, what ones should I, you know, go in and track down? I had seen Fury. And I had seen Dead End. I'd forgotten I'd seen Dead End, but I'd asked you which ones to track down, and you mentioned a few, and I went and saw them all. And she doesn't have, I think, like that sort of star glamour thing that Betty Davis had, or Carol Lombard had, or Joan Crawford had, where they kind of just radiate that kind of star energy that movie stars kind of had, that ineffable quality that you just can't pinpoint, but you know it when you see it. You're like, oh yeah, that person just pops. But yet, she's not a character actress either. You know,
no.
I mean, she's not fifth billed, who shows up for a couple of scenes. And in a lot of the movies, she's the female lead of the movie. As I mentioned, you know, going toe to toe with these titans of the golden age of Hollywood.
She's also, I think, the only actress to work with Fritz Lang 3 times, which is pretty crazy. Notoriously difficult, Fritz Lang.
Right.
Because I think she was also really no nonsense. She, you know, she grew up doing theater, and she was very professional. And she never, I don't think she ever really bought into any of that star persona. She didn't buy into the star behavior. She was a very practical person who's passionate about acting. And I love that about her.
Yeah, they mention a few times in the book that, like, you know, she goes out to Hollywood and she seems sort of dismissive of the whole thing, the whole enterprise, to a certain extent. And it's sort of funny. I didn't plan it this way, but this episode is sort of a direct sequel to the one we just did last month on Clara Bow, because Sylvia Sidney ends up making her big splat, not her debut, as I mentioned, she was in the D.W. Griffith film, but her big moment is in the film City Streets with Gary Cooper, which had been originally penciled to be with Clara Bow. And yep. She even gets Clara Bow's dressing room. So she picks up quite literally where Clara Bow leaves off and then has this whole separate career. But at the same time, like in the middle of her, you know, she's just getting bigger and bigger movies. She then decides to go back to New York and go do theater work. And, you know, we think about nowadays, that's just hopping on a plane. But in 1931, that required a little more effort to do. That seemed probably like a bigger move than that. And every time she did that, I was reading the book, every time she would do that, I'm like, wow, she really was just sort of taking herself out of the mix at the exact moment you think you'd want to be there. And I said, I think that's because she just didn't think of her career like that. She just was like, oh, what's the next interesting thing? I'm going to go do that, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, she really didn't have any, it seems, especially when you watch some of her interviews when she was older, she really didn't have any airs about, like, greatness in that sense of, like, leaving a lasting impression as a great star. But she did have intentions of doing interesting work. And wanted to work with people who knew what they were doing, which is why she worked with difficult directors, because she didn't mind being sort of molded by them. Whereas a lot of them, you know, like Bette Davis obviously was her own auteur and she wanted to be her own. She was her own painter in all of these films that she's in. And so she would move around from director to director until she found someone who let her be in the reins. Whereas Sylvia Sidney was more, I'm the clay, mold me. You know, and was able to work with directors who like actors like that, which I think is an interesting way of looking at this era, the Hollywood, classic Hollywood era. Is it's not like some actors had it better and some directors had it better, or whatever. What's interesting is to find the actors who found the directors that worked well for them and the directors who found actors that worked well for them. And I think that's an interesting way of looking at that jumble. And so when you have like tensions and battles, instead of looking at it as like this star versus this director, it should be looked at like in that sort of star, or the Hollywood machine. It's harder to find a director that fits with you. Whereas nowadays, obviously, you know, if you're, trying to think of somebody who, oh yeah, if you're Robert De Niro, right? You know that Martin Scorsese works well with you, so you try to work with him as much as you can, and you have the freedom of that. These actors didn't have that, and so you have a lot more tension. But Sylvia Sidney was somebody who was able to work within those confines to find those directors that fit well with her style.
When I was going through the list of films that, you know, that she was in, I mean, this is not a complete list or anything like that, but like the fact that she could work with like Dorothy Arzner and then Fritz Lang, as you mentioned, like that are, those are two very different people.
Very different kind of filmmakers.
and deliver these amazing performances. You know, the comedy in Merrily We Go to Hell, and then the sort of social drama in Fury, at least. But yeah, I mean, that's, and yet she was very, I don't know, I don't want to say not her own worst enemy. That's probably a little severe, but she definitely didn't really hide how she felt about all this stuff. You know, she was very open about, this is all a bunch of garbage. This is all this, and this is nonsense. Or if she didn't like somebody, she told them, which is, again, pretty stunning for someone who you would think could benefit from just kind of going along with everybody.
Yeah, my favorite story in Paid by the Tear is when she threw a glass at Humphrey Bogart and like cut his lip or something. And then Lauren Bacall's like, you deserved it.
Yes.
Because he insulted her. But she was very fiery. And then later in life, she had pugs. And I love pugs. So anybody who loves pugs, I'm always like, yes, my people.
She had a pug named Captain Midnight.
Yeah, she loved
which
her
I just wanted
so
to get
much.
Into the show. You know, I think just found that so charming.
She also is someone who was really practical about the finances and didn't imagine she was going to get rich doing this work, because very few actors got rich, and later in life made more money selling her needlepoint books than she ever did acting. Cause I think one of her books went into like a seventh or eighth printing, cause it was the arts and crafts 70s, you know, and she was like, I could do this.
Yeah, that was
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, she was married 3 times. None of the marriages ever lasting terribly long. In fact, the first one to Bennett Cerf, it was like a couple of months, which is like in the back then was pretty scandalous. But she had a son, and the son had a lot of health issues, and she had to take care of him. And as you said, like, she had to just keep working. She couldn't, you know, she was not, as we said, like a Betty Davis or Joan Crawford, who you can imagine got rich from being in movies and maybe could live a more opulent lifestyle and maybe worked because they liked to work. She had to work. She was a working actress, and, you know, it wasn't like she never made, you know, millions of dollars on her movies. So she had to just keep sort of plugging away. And that's why when you get into, like, she's doing theater, she's doing TV, she's doing, you know, she's doing TV movies, and then she's coming back and doing movies. I mean, she never kind of turned down an opportunity to ply her craft, because like, part of it was the practical of like, I gotta feed the dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. And she also, you know, is an interesting case in how in film, once you hit a certain age, and we still kind of see it now, once you hit a certain age as a woman, people don't want to cast you. There's sort of a lack of roles for women between 40 and 60.
Sure, yeah.
Which is about when she took her break. Mm-hmm. And then she came back and could be the, you know, sassy mother-in-law or the sassy grandma or the cranky old lady. She did quite a few great cranky old lady movies. She has her penultimate film, Use People, is one of my favorite films.
Oh, she's terrific in that, yeah.
She's very saucy. But it's kind of depressing to see, like, there wasn't, you know, film work. She could do TV work and she could do stage work in those years, but there wasn't really film work for a woman in her 40s and 50s. It's really shitty.
She's in a movie, a 1950s, I think it's 55, Violent Saturday, which is a Richard Fleischer film.
Yes.
And I really liked Violent Saturday.
It's a good movie.
Yeah, I didn't expect it to like it as much as I did. I mean, it's got this amazing cast, Lee Marvin, Ernest Borgnine, Victor Mature, and she's got a tiny part in it. But man, it was like, I wish she was in it more. You know, like, you every time she shows up, you're like, oh, and then there was a point where there's this, I'm not going to give it away because I actually think people should track down and see it. It's really interesting. But there's a scene in a bank, and I'm assuming during a bank robbery that she's going to get killed because it's a bank robbery. And for a 1950s movie, it's pretty violent. Like, they are just shooting.
It lives up to its name.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It really is Violent Saturday.
And Lee Marvin shows up and he just starts killing cast members. And I'm like, wow. And there was a part where, like, I think for just a moment, I looked away. I think like my dog needed something or something like that. And then the movie kept going, and then it moves away from the bank. And I'm like, wait a minute. That's it. Did I miss her getting killed in the movie? And then I had to go back and I'm like, oh, no, she doesn't. She just kind of, they just sort of get rid of her, not kill her off, but she just has like one scene and then she's done. And I'm like, that's it for her. Like, you've got Sylvia Sidney in this. Like, she just seems like, you want to see her more. And from what I read of that is like, maybe scenes had been cut or something like that. Because apparently there's like stills where you see their scenes or she wasn't in it. But especially in her later period, she really is like this little firecracker of energy. And as you say, like, she didn't get a chance to play a lot of main parts, because it said she was like considered an older woman at that point, and there weren't a lot of parts for her. But everything that she's in at the end, near the second half of her career, I'm like, oh, I wish she was in this more.
Yeah, even like the one that she got her Oscar nomination for, she's in it for about, what, 20, like 25 minutes?
Yeah, yeah.
And not to spoil why she's not in it for the rest of the movie, but she really absolutely nails those 25 minutes. And then when she's gone, you're like, oh no. And like, I love Joanne Woodward, but I was watching that movie for Sylvia Sidney and then she was gone and I was like, oh, this is what this movie is doing to me.
So, okay. Before we get too far into the latter part of her career, I do want to talk about her early stuff. Do you have a favorite performance of hers from the early stuff or a favorite film or ones you think that are really, I mean, you highlighted to me to see City Streets and Street mm-hmm. Scene and Merrily We Go to Hell, Fury, Dead End and Sabotage. And I'd seen a couple of those and then I caught up with the rest of them. I don't know how I didn't see Sabotage. I think I thought I've seen every Hitchcock movie. I don't know. I missed out maybe because it was one of his British ones.
Sabotage is one that, I think the one time Hitchcock regretted including something in a movie. And so it's not one that's, played often. I don't want to spoil it because when I watched the movie and he did the thing where I'm like, I see why you regretted doing this. I was like, holy shit, he did that. There's a moment that happens in the movie that I think he goes a little too far into violence. And he actually said in later interviews, like, I shouldn't have done that. Whoops. And you're like, yeah, you shouldn't have. I was watching it. I remember we had this on Filmstruck and I was watching it on like an iPad at making lunch or something. And that moment happened and I was like, Hitchcock, what year? When? And I was like, this movie is from 1936 and you did that in this movie and then you got away with it. But then, you know, because it was British, they didn't have quite the same censors. There's no way that would have happened in the U.S. movie.
No.
At all. I think this movie is on Criterion Channel. So if anyone is interested, that's how you should watch that one. But the ones I had you watch are really my favorite. I love Merrily We Go to Hell. I think that's my favorite of her performances. The ending is a little, you know, studio ending-ness. Mm-hmm. But everything up to the last 5 minutes is like so fiery and so it still feels really modern in the ways that her character has agency and makes bad decisions, but she owns up to her bad decisions and she's really, really good in it. I like her in An American Tragedy, which is the original adaptation of the Dreiser novel, which later became A Place in the Sun. She plays the Shelley Winters role. And she's really good. The movie is not great,
mm-hmm.
but because she has a similar energy to similar energy to Shelley Winters. And you can see why they both really made a meal out of that. The role of the like second choice woman. But at the same time, I can't remember who it is that plays the Elizabeth Taylor one, but it's like one of those, you chose this person over Sylvia Sidney. What are you doing? Oh, it's Frances D, I think. I love Frances D, but she's not so lucid me. So that one's pretty good. I also really like 30 Day Princess, which is a Cary Grant movie, mostly because it's one of the few sort of straight kind of romantic comedies she ever made. She made a lot of like suffering movies, hence the Paid by the Tear. Yeah, she made a lot of suffering movies where she was a suffering wife, a suffering girlfriend, a suffering big sister. In 30 Day Princess, she gets to be something totally different. She I think she plays like a double role, pretending to be a princess and then actually the princess. And it's just she gets to wear beautiful gowns and be bubbly and like flirt with Cary Grant. And it's like, who doesn't want that? And she gets to play two different roles. So you get to see a lot of her range. And it's just a very frothy sort of end of the pre-code era, beautiful people doing zany things kind of movie. But it's not one that plays often. I think that was one of the ones when they did The Summer Under the Stars Day. It was one of the few I hadn't actually seen because most of what they programmed were ones I had seen. But that one I hadn't seen and I really, really loved it. Wish she'd gotten to do more like effervescent comedies like that, sort of a I think who was similar, like you mentioned Carol Lombard, like it's more of a Carol Lombard kind of frothy comedy than what you normally expect her to be in. Clearly those weren't the scripts that were coming her way most of the time, because almost every one of her movies from the 30s she's, you know, suffering in some way or another.
in Merrily We Go to Hell, when Frederick March cheats on her and her attitude is she says something to the effect of, I'm a modern woman, so she's going to get to cheat on him.
Yeah.
That's pretty startling because you're like, what, in a 1930s movie, she's going to do that?
Also, the man she's cheating with is also like pre-fame Cary Grant. And you're like, I love Friedrich March, but like he is really shitty to her. And Cary Grant's Cary Grant. It's like, I don't buy that she would go back to him. But I showed it to my boyfriend, Robert, and he, Robert Daniels, also a writer. He was like, I don't buy this. The minute Cary Grant shows up, why would she go back to Friedrich March? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know either. I can't answer that. Because the script told her to, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely one of those. Like, when the other man is Cary Grant, it's like, what do you even...
Right. Yeah, it's Cary Grant, right. Yeah.
Who's competing with Cary Grant? Nobody. That's who.
It's such a weird thing to look at, you know, watch a movie with the credits and you look at the names and you see Cary Grant and his name is like ninth.
Yeah.
It just looks weird. You're just like, wait, why is Cary Grant?
Well, like in Mars Attacks, I was counting the where everyone has landed, and you know, Danny DeVito is fifth and he's got two scenes.
Yeah.
And then Jack Black is like 19th, and it's like, when's the last time Jack Black was 19th? You know, like he's such a big star now. So crazy to watch movies. So like thinking of Mars Attacks as like Sylvia Sidney's last movie, but like Jack Black's like one of his first. Fascinating.
Yeah. Oh man. Like I said, there's so much stuff I want to talk about. Mars Attacks. I will mention some of the movies again. You told me to watch Street Scene, right? And this is a very embarrassing thing I'm going to admit, but I'm going to admit it. So I'm watching the movie, right? And it opens up on this stoop in New York City, and it's all these people walking by and interacting with one another. And I'm watching it, and I'm enjoying it, but I'm going, God, this opening scene is really long. This opening scene in on the stoop is just really, really long. Like, when are they going to eventually? And then I realized, oh, wait, the name of the damn movie is Street Scene and it's based on a play, which means the whole thing is going to be
the whole movie is on the street. Yes.
Like 25 minutes in, I'm like, wait, this is a really long opening gambit for this movie. They're like, oh, wait. Oh, okay. And even that movie again deals with adultery in a kind of very frank manner.
Yeah, it's a real, like, she's so luminous in this movie, even though she is, you know, just an average, like, is this the, I can't remember, yeah, it's Lower East Side, she's just like an average tenement person, and you're like, this woman is too beautiful to be in this situation. She should be in the Follies or something. But I this is one I got to see at the TCM Film Festival. Can't remember what year it was, but they showed like MoMA's 35mm print or something, and it was so gorgeous. And you know, King Vidor is just like one of the all-time great directors. And he really uses like bits of his sort of silent film fluid camera techniques. So even though it's from 1931, and even though it is kind of stagey, it feels bigger than it, than a lot of 1931 stage bound movies. And I think it's partly because King Vidor is such a great visual filmmaker, and partly because Sylvia Sidney, like, really is larger than life as an actress.
One of the things I noticed about a bunch of these early ones is, except we talked about earlier, that like she was, I think it was Dashiell Hammett called her the ugly little duckling or something like that, and or ugly little baby or whatever it was. And but each of those films has at least one or two massive close-ups of her.
Yeah,
I mean, where her face is the entire screen. There's a scene in Sabotage where she's looking at her husband, who she thinks might be a saboteur. And it's just her. There's quite literally nothing else in the frame, just her face, where her eyes are kind of darting off to the side. And like,
that shot in City Streets, where she's like looking right down the camera with the
yes,
thing.
Yes,
yeah, she looks freaking badass. And then in Marilyn, We Go to Hell, there's a scene where she's driving her car. She also looks amazing.
Yeah, I mean,
so good.
Yeah, I mean, that's. Not everybody can do that. You know what I mean? There's lots of people that you do close-ups on and it doesn't radiate anything.
Yeah.
It's just kind of blank, but yet she's filling this, again, for someone who I don't, again, I don't think of as like a, you know, giant glamour movie star, like said, like a Betty Davis or stuff like that. She fills that screen. By the way, City Streets, I really did. I had never seen it before and I really enjoyed it. On a side note for that film, I was not familiar with super young Gary Cooper.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like how kind of flinty and nervous energy he is. Cause I'm used to him more as like the older Gary Cooper, who's become this pillar of Americana and American ideals, like, you know, High Noon and stuff. Even Sergeant York, he's already kind of already, that's only 10 years after City Streets, but in 31, he's really kind of just edgy on screen. And it was kind of cool to see Gary Cooper in that kind of persona. That's not anything I was really familiar with.
He's like that in a couple of silent films as well. The Winning of Barbara Worth with Ronald Coleman, and Wings with Claire Beau, right?
Yeah.
Very small scene in Wings, but he has that same, like, he's one of those guys that's kind of, I think his good looks is how he made it from the silent era to the talkie era, because he's really creaky in these early 30s films. And he was kind of creaky in the silent films too. He just had a really beautiful face and he was tall, so it worked out nicely for him. And if you're used to seeing him in his later films, like from Sergeant York on, it is really shocking to see how not good he was. Or not necessarily not good, but definitely like green in these early ones, where you're like, wow, you kept going. And then he really became like a film persona, like a Gary Cooper type.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
But he really had to feel his way into that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to get off of Sylvie Sidney, but there was a quote I remembered in a Orson Welles book where he talked about Gary Cooper, and he said that he had been on a set where they were some Gary Cooper movie, and he was just visiting. Wells was just visiting, and they were watching Gary Cooper shoot some scene, and Wells goes, God, he's awful. This guy's terrible. He's just absolutely awful. And then the director shows him the dailies, and Wells goes, oh my God, there it is.
Yeah.
And he was like, if you're watching it in the moment, it doesn't look like anything, but there's something about the way he could project himself that the minute it was filmed on celluloid, he became Gary Cooper.
The camera added a lot. And I think you can see, if you watch his career, you can see him figure out how to bring out more of himself that the camera pulls out.
Mm.
That's why I think, like, this podcast is really interesting, because you can see the growth of, I love seeing the growth of both, like, a director and their style, or seeing an actor and how, you know, did they have it right away or did they have to build towards it? And Gary Cooper is definitely someone who had to build towards it. Whereas Sylvia Sidney, I think, was amazing right away. Mm-hmm. And she was on two of her Broadway shows when she was a teen. People would say, like, she was stealing the show. I think she was on a show with Kay Francis, and it was like everybody knew in that cast that she and Kay Francis were going to go take over Hollywood, because they were like head and shoulders better than anybody on the cast. And thankfully, you know, it really worked out for both of them. And they were both, like, what's fascinating about Kay Francis too is they're both really sort of, neither of them were interested in the game. They just wanted to work and make money. And Kay Francis retired and was like, I just want to die. And Sylvia Sidney, towards the end of her life, was like, I just want to spend all of my money now that I know I'm going to die soon. And I think that's really inspiring.
Yeah. Enjoy it, you know? I do want to mention 1956 Behind the High Wall. Have you seen that one?
Have I seen? Let's see.
It's the prison drama where she's the wheelchair bound wife of the warden, and the warden gets kidnapped by escaped prisoners, and then they all die, and they leave their money behind. And the warden is like, well, geez, I could steal this money and no one would know, because he needs it for his crippled wife, who is Sylvia Sidney. And
yeah, I don't think I've seen that one.
It's on YouTube. The whole thing's on YouTube. It's a very strange film, because it's totally a B movie with a B level production budget. and all these stars that John Gavin is in it, his first film. So, I mean, you see him, you're like, oh, okay, he's going to, you know, he's going to turn it. We're going to be in Psycho in a couple of years. But it's a bunch of unknowns. And then Sylvia Sidney.
And then Sylvia Sidney. Wow. Yeah, no, I haven't seen this one.
And you know, the paid by the tear thing came up because the movie, not spoiler alert, literally ends with her sobbing. It is, they literally put the end over her sobbing face. And I'm like, well, there it is. There, but it's such a discordant note to see this giant movie star who has this connection to all of these great legends of Hollywood in this kind of B-level program, which again, I actually enjoyed. It's very grungy and it's very violent. Again, it's like sort of unusually violent for a 1956 kind of crime film. But, yeah, she's constantly sort of being, they're sort of, the music is always swelling because she's, you know, oh, I know if I only hadn't had that car accident, we'd be able to, there's lots of that kind of stuff in it. So you're like, okay. Another one I wanted to mention was a TV movie she did called Do Not Fold, Spindle, or Mutilate.
I was looking at that one. That's another one I have not seen, but it sounds amazing. Did you track that one down?
I did. I've always wanted to see it because I love Myrna Loy. I've always loved Myrna Loy, and she's in it. And it's her.
And Helen Hayes.
Helen Hayes. Fantastic. And Mildred Natwick. And it is, for anyone, again, this is on YouTube as well, everybody.
Okay, I gotta track this down.
An insane premise of four old biddies that have nothing else to do but lunch together. And they basically just cause trouble by, in this case, they're getting involved with computer dating, and they make up a person as a potential date for other people on this system. And they're doing it just for the hell of it. And the guy that they attract with their made up woman ends up being like a murderer.
That's amazing. Yeah, I have to find this.
It's really, and it's like these four old biddies are having this.
Shot by Stanley Cortez.
It's
who
so
did Night of the Hunter and the Andersons. What?
It's so weird. And there's like Vince Edwards is the killer, and there's all this voiceover where he's like, oh yeah, she's not gonna turn me down this time. And then they cut to the Myrna Loy and Sylvia Sidney kind of being like, oh my god, what have we done? And then they become kind of detectives. It's
this sounds amazing. Yes.
We are
less of a people because we don't have the ABC movie of the week anymore.
Oh, seriously.
There's so many good ones. This sounds amazing. Also, the title is just like, that's a great title.
It is. It really jumps out of you. I used to have a book, The Films of Myrna Loy, and I would get to that. I'm like, what is this movie? What a title. Yeah. What a strange title. And they're talking about the computer cards. That's what they're talking about. The cards that like literally put into the machine. You can't mess them up because it'll mess up the sister or whatever. So yeah, so she's in that, and she looks like she's just having a blast because she's working with these three other legendary figures.
Yeah. I just bought Helen Hayes's autobiography. I found it for like a dollar. I'm very excited.
Yeah. the lives these people led are, and Helen Hayes is really the star of it. She's the lead. She's really the lead of the four of them. So that was a lot of fun. And they said, I enjoyed Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams. What do you think of that movie? I thought it was a little odd tonally.
It definitely goes a lot of places. It's one of those movies where it feels almost like three movies, sort of every time it shifts.
Yeah. It's like the fantasy film sequences.
Yeah, you know? the fantasy film sequences. I think what's interesting is that Joanne Woodward was always in these kind of movies that don't, like, aren't categorizable. I don't know what word I'm looking for. but you know what I'm trying to say. Like, they defy genre, a lot of her films, because I think she was always trying to do projects that were like a film or TV version of experimental theater.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what I kind of think of when I think of her career, especially in the 70s and 80s. And she's fantastic in this, as is Martin Balsam. It's a really good cast. As you said, strange tone. It shifts a lot. It's definitely dealing with a lot of very 70s ideas of like women, and like marriage I feel like nobody was having a good marriage in the 70s. It's definitely one of those movies. It's 1973, so like divorce wasn't as common as it is now. So you had all these movies where like you're really not sure if the movie realizes that the reason the woman is like terrible is actually just because she's been stuck in this marriage that she wasn't able to get divorced out of. It's like one of those movies, which is like a there's one called The Happy Ending that also has a very similar sort of where I can't tell if the movie realizes that this woman is awful, not because she's actually awful, but because life has made her awful.
Yeah, it was said it, Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams is that it's sort of all over the place. Like I said, they go, her and Joanne Woodward and her mother, played by Sylvie Sidney, go to a Wild Strawberries, and then like she's watching it, and then she starts seeing herself in the movie, and that's like this weird. And then, so, spoiler alert, everybody, Sylvie Sidney dies in the movie theater, getting one of the great exit lines in all of.
Yes.
Cancel my appointments, which is funny. Like, it's funny, but then the movie seems to be very serious at the second half of it. So yeah, I
Yeah,
just.
it gets dark, and definitely I feel like a movie where all the everything could be resolved if they just got divorced. Just get divorced.
So I mentioned she's in God Told Me To, which is again the Larry Cohen classic, and she was in the TV movie Snow Beast, which is fun. She's in Damien Omen 2, which is one of those movies that's not very good, but it's fun as hell to watch because it's just so absurd and it's doing its best to just kind of top the first film. I enjoyed her as a kind of cranky grandma in, or no, not the grandma, she's a mother in a TV movie called Pals that she did with Don Ameche. You mentioned him earlier,
Yeah,
and
Don Ameche.
George C. Scott, which is. I'm trying to imagine being a director taking on the task of directing Sylvie Sidney and George C. Scott. Like that's an uphill climb.
That's yeah. She's also really fun in Hammett.
I haven't
The
seen Hammett yet.
it's
I,
Ben Benders, so it's not like if you're going in and you're like you want it to just be straight up like Dashiell Hammett.
Right.
It's not. It goes places because it's Van Vendors and it's
Because
a
it's
little
Wim
cheap.
Wenders,
It's a
sure.
little, it's a little like woozy is a kind of the best way. A little off kilter, but Friedrich Forrest is fantastic in it and she's great. She's another one where she's like, she probably worked for like 2 days and finished her whole role. She's also in a movie that I still haven't seen and I keep meaning to see when she was doing all these TV movies in the 80s called Finnegan Begin Again by Joan Micklyn Silver.
I didn't know that she directed that.
Yeah, and with Mary Tyler Moore and Robert Preston, Sam Waterston, Sylvie Sidney. And I keep meaning to watch it and I have not gotten around to it. And I feel like the worst Sylvia Sidney slash Joan Micklyn Silver fan for having still not seen this movie. Someday I'll get to
She
it.
was also in An Early Frost, which was with Aidan Quinn, which was one of the first AIDS movies, the first movies
Yeah.
to even tackle the topic.
Yeah, she got one of her Emmy nominations for that.
So it said there was an I hadn't seen it. Speaking of things I haven't seen, she did another TV movie with Martin Balsam. I love Martin Balsam, by the way. This is one of my
He's
favorite
so
character
good.
actors.
Yeah, he's so
But
good.
there's this TV movie they did about they're an older couple and they're living in New York and their neighborhood is kind of changing around them. It's becoming a little rougher and it's about the adjustment that older people have to make with the world changing around them. And when I was reading about it in the book, the original title is like Lovers in 3B. And then when they aired it, they renamed it Siege.
Yeah,
I'm like, that's a bit of a change
that
from
makes so
Lovers
much
in 3B.
sense.
See, like, okay, I guess I'm gonna watch Martin Balsam do like a Charles Bronson thing. Is that what this movie's about? I don't know. So I do want to track that one down too, because like I said, I love Martin Balsam as well. So then, she continues to work, and then Tim Burton enters her life. And you mentioned Don Ameche. It's like Quentin Tarantino gets all this credit. Deserved, but gets all this credit for like, oh, he's digging out all these old actors and giving them a second life. John Travolta or Pam Grier, whatever he's doing, Michael Parks. But here's Tim Burton in the 80s
Yeah.
giving this juicy role to Sylvia Sidney. And I love the idea that she rejects him three times. Just like, you know, here's this big ticket up and coming director. And she's like, no, leave me alone. You know, and she literally, she said, tosses the script into the trash. But to be fair, like, we look at Beetlejuice now and you're like, oh, it's a classic. But I can imagine that we have the benefit of knowing what it looks like.
Yeah.
Because we know it. But I imagine on paper, it probably was like, what the hell is this? Yeah. So I can't blame her. She probably was like, this movie doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, I love the story about her just basically being like, leave me alone. You weird man. Until she actually met him. I think it's really sweet that he was that passionate.
Yep.
And then, like, because he's probably, you know, I wrote a piece about her in Beetlejuice and for its anniversary earlier this year, and I kept trying to find an interview where he talked about her. I even have Burton on Burton, his, like, book of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find anything explaining, like, what did he see in her?
Mm.
Which is kind of like, if I ever meet Tim Burton, I'm just going to be like, I need verbatim. I need to hear your story on, like, why you loved her, because I've done research. I couldn't find any interviews with him. He doesn't really do a lot of interviews. He's not really an interview kind of guy, but except for the ones that are in Burton on Burton, which was why it was disappointing that he didn't talk about Sylvia Sidney in it. Because clearly he saw something, like, in seeing her, maybe that was reflected in himself, and then Sylvia Sidney saw it in him when they met, right? And so it's like, I need to know.
It's one
of those, like, I, you know, all these Burton movies that I love, this is the one question. If I get one question, I need to know.
I would love to know what movies of hers struck him, because, like, you know, we know, like, he loved Vincent Price, right? Well, you can guess what movies that he loved from Vincent Price, because those are all, you know, all the Vincent Price horror movies, those are right up Tim Burton's alley. But what was it in Sylvia Sidney's filmography that he
watching
really
the Fritz Lang's one? Was he watching? Did he like Sabotage? Like, what was it?
Yeah. And so it is incredibly sweet that he would. This is a guy, again, he's an up and comer. He directs Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and he's on his way, and he takes time out to fly all the way out to New York to pitch this to her. And then she finally relents, and then she's great at it. She's so funny. She's kind of playing herself to a certain extent in that she's this, you know, she just doesn't have any time for any nonsense. You know, I mean, she's so funny. The old bits about the, you know, the football players, you know, they're like, coach, I don't think we survived that bus crash. And she's like, I'm not your coach. You know, like, she's not in it a lot. But good Lord, is she funny. I mean, and they get the smoke emitting from her, the neck wound.
She's so funny in this. Yeah. And what's great is if you've watched any of her later, you know, interviews, like there's a 30-minute interview with her that TCM did, I think is on their YouTube channel. And she is really not that much different. you know, like she doesn't like dumb questions, you know, mm-hmm. like or simple questions. She wants, you know, if you have a, she wants a good question. And you kind of feel that in Juno, where she's just been dealing with people for who knows how long. And she just doesn't have time for this anymore.
Yeah. She wants the Maitlands to read the book for the handbook for the recently deceased. And she's frustrated that they haven't, you know, so she's really, really funny in it. And it just, she's this, you know, we're kind of in, obviously the Maitlands are our gateway to the, we're as bewildered by this world as they are with the sandworms and what the hell ever Betelgeuse is doing and all this stuff. And then she's just kind of she's put upon worker. And, again, I love that it's the whole idea of the dead, you know, the afterlife is just endless bureaucracy. It just continues on forever.
more paperwork
to do. And she's just terrific in it. So then that kind of gets her another bit of a leg up. You know, you mentioned she's in Used People, and she's terrific in that. And
which I discovered is on Tubi. So
yes,
if you
that's where I watched
People,
it. Yes.
It is on Tubi.
Yeah, she's funny in that. It's all her scenes are almost with Jessica Tandy. But they're really sweet together. You know, they have a really great rapport. And so she's great in that. And then she continues to work. And then Burton comes back to her to do Mars Attacks. And it's so funny. You look at Burton's filmography, right? And he does Beetlejuice, giant hit. He does Batman, career changing, industry changing, pop culture changing thing. He does Edward Scissorhands, which is clearly kind of for him, but that's a hit. Then he does Batman Returns. And you could sort of see he decides, okay, I'm going to cash in these chits now, because his next two films are Ed Wood, which I love. It's one of my all-time favorite films.
So good.
Uncommercial in the extreme. And then Mars Attacks. And so you can sort of see he's just like, okay, I'm going to do the things I want to do. And so he pitches this role to her, Grandma Norris, Lucas Haas's grandmother. And she gets, apparently just before she agrees to do it, but then she gets into a car accident. She's like hit on a city street by a car, a hit and run, it says in the book, which is startling.
Yeah.
And she ends up in the hospital, and Burton flies out to see her. Again, unbelievable level of detail and care that a film director would go for this. And he tells her, I will shoot your scenes later so you have time to recover.
Yeah.
I mean, that is unbelievable.
I mean, the role was written for her. It was conceived for her. You don't even have that movie without her performance. Her performance is so perfect for the, like, absurdity of the entire plot. And who's going to do that? Nobody.
Yeah. It really, yeah. I remembered hearing about this movie at the time when it was coming out, and I was really excited about it because I was like, oh, this feels like Tim Burton's this is the most Tim Burton-y thing imaginable. And I remember he said at the time he wanted to do his own version of kind of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which, again, one of my all-time favorite movies. So I'm like, okay. And the cast he assembles for this film is unreal. I mean, you've got Jack Nicholson in a dual role, Pierce Brosnan, Sarah Jessica Parker, Annette Bening, Michael J. Fox, Martin Short, Lucas Haas, Joe Don Baker, Jack Black, Jim Brown, Pam Grier, Danny DeVito, Glenn Close, Natalie Portman, Rod Steiger, Lisa Marie, Paul Winfield, and Tom Jones. I mean,
and Olan Jones.
And Olan, I mean, just
amazing,
real. Now, it came out in December 12th, 1996. Normally, this is in the show where I detail the plot, but I found that the IMDb log line is actually sufficient. It is simply, Earth is invaded by Martians with unbeatable weapons and a cruel sense of humor.
That's perfect.
That's about right.
The shits and giggles. That's my favorite thing about this movie is every time whether it's the, Warhawk, Rod Steiger, or it's this, the, like, yet let's use logic scientist, neither of their, or the, you know, Jack Nicholson as president, his like smooth politician, nothing works because they're not logical. They're jokesters. They, you know, like puff the nuclear reactor, like as if it's like pot or something. It's hilarious. This everything is just a joke for them. Like they probably got bored and that's why they invaded, you know?
I think that's why the movie didn't do super well, because it has all the trappings and all the visuals of a Independence Day style blockbuster, but it's got that dark humor of Burton's, and it's in some ways it's kind of, I don't know what to say, not nihilistic, but it is a little nihilistic, and that it is
nihilistic, yeah. And it's
anything that you're expecting the film to do is not going to happen, as you say. Like the scientist character, he's wrong. The war guy, he's wrong.
Yeah.
The president who tries to get, can't we all just get along? He's wrong. The movie just keeps pulling the rug out from the audience. Like, oh, this is what you're expecting? Nope, not giving it to you. And I think that's frustrating for some people.
Yeah. And there's no, like, I think what's kind of politically interesting about the film, not that this is necessarily an overtly political film, but it kind of is because it's coming out in the middle of the end of the Cold War, the beginning of like the never ending oil wars, right? And there is no actual, like, villain. Like, yes, the Martians are villains, but they're not, like, traditional evil. And the Americans are not traditional good either. Nobody is good. Nobody's evil. Everything's in a gray area. they're doing violence just because they can, and they probably think it's funny. There's no valor in for anybody. They get, you know, conquered not because of a real hero, in the greater sense of like a great man hero or something, right? It's just an accident,
just random dumb luck. Yeah, Slim Whitman records. Yeah,
what's really funny about this, I always love this song, but about maybe 5 years ago or 6 years ago, I inherited a bunch of records from my grandparents, and my dad shipped them to me. This was when I was living in Atlanta, and I opened the box and I was like digging through it, and I was super excited. You know what was in the pile of records from my grandparents? That Slim Whitman album, the exact one.
The exact
that, like,
one?
Blows up the Martians' heads. And I was like, oh my God, if the Martians come, we're set. But it's just so funny. It's like, it's absurd. And she like, half the time you're not sure if she actually is losing her mind in this movie.
That's what,
like,
I wanted to ask you, because I can't tell how she's playing it. Yeah.
I think you're not supposed to know, because I think she's kind of like the Martians, where she's got no point in her life, where she's just like, I could fuck with everybody if I want to. So I'm going to. And she knows that. I think you can tell that she knows that nobody cares about her except the one grandkid.
Which is really sweet. I love that. I love that Lucas Haas's character really dotes on her. Like, even like, he leaves his family to go save her, and the rest of the family is like, they don't care. But like, there's the scene where Jack Black's character goes off to war, right? And they're giving him the salute, and he's getting on the bus, and he says goodbye to her, and she says, you know, goodbye, Thomas. And he's like, I'm not Thomas, Grandma. And she's like, I know, Thomas. And you're like, oh, okay, she's out of it, right? She's just out of it. But then she's in the car with Lucas Haas, and he's talking about the invasion, and he's like, boy, some of the stuff you've seen in life must have been amazing. You must have been really excited when they invented the train.
Yeah,
and all
she's
of a
like,
sudden,
I'm not that old.
Yeah, she snaps right into it. So you're like, oh, well, is she faking this whole time? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I truly think she's faking it. She's just, you know, I think she's just had it. I think Grandma has earned her being a little bit wily.
And it's her line read on the scene where the Martians go to visit Congress, and they kill everybody, and they cut to her going, they blew up Congress, and she cackles madly. Yeah. That was in every piece of marketing.
With every piece of marketing, because it's like the best part of the whole movie. It's so funny.
She just delighted.
We all feel that way to some extent, you know, like, she's the one who's seen, at this point, she's seen Congress fuck up so many times.
I've mentioned this on other shows that I've done, other podcasts, and I'm never having done any sort of acting or being in this arena where I would even be around actors. This is probably highly unprofessional, but I can't help it. Like, so Lucas Haas, right? Most of his scenes are with Sylvia Sidney.
Yeah.
And she has a little bit with Joe Don Baker, which is just funny, by the way, just like the idea of Sylvia Sidney and Joe Don Baker in the same scene. Like, what did they talk about? Like,
yeah.
Around the craft service.
Like, I was just thinking, like, again, like Jack Black at the beginning of his career and Sylvia Sidney. I like it's same thing with, like, if I ever get one question with Jack Black, I'll be like, do you have any Sylvia Sidney stories? Did she yell at you? Like, I need to hear it.
Right, exactly. Right. So, say if I was Lucas Haas, right, and I was working with an actor who had worked with Fritz Lang and Spencer Tracy and Humphrey Bogart and Henry Fonda, I think I'd just be like, I'm not going to go back to my trailer. Can we just sit and can you just tell me stories? And I don't know whether that's professional or not. Maybe some actors would be like, leave me alone, I don't want to talk. But I couldn't help it. I think I'd just be like, you worked with Hitchcock. Tell me what that was like. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I feel like she would be the kind that wouldn't want that.
Probably not.
but I would definitely be tempted. It's how do you not ask about that?
So she's great in it. And by the way, I think she looks great. Like, she looks younger than she does as Juno. Part of it's the hair. She's given this kind of, like, I don't know.
Little bob.
Yeah, is that what it's called?
Yeah, she has a little bob.
She looks great. Like, she look, even though Mars Attacks is a full 8 years after Beetlejuice, she just looks, to me, looks younger. and she just looks terrific, and she gets a bunch of great comedy lines. She, unlike most of the cast, lives through the film. She gets to make it to the end. She's on the steps of the Capitol.
That's kind of what I love about that, the way that they film that scene too, where she's just listening to her music. She's in her world. But everyone is dying or outside. Everyone is dying in her home. She's just in her own space. And then the Martians, they're such dicks. They're going to like bring this big giant, like obscenely large weapon to like kill this little lady in a wheelchair. And because of their, you know, shits and giggles hubris, that's how they end up all dying. It's because they, you know, they were being dicks and they got what was coming to them. It's great. I love it.
I really did enjoy watching it over again. I had just forgotten how loosey goosey Burton gets with it. And again, when you have a film with this cast, it gives it a sense of like self importance because Jack Nicholson in a dual role.
Yeah.
You know?
And playing like such doofuses in both roles. Yeah. Glenn Close at this point, probably other than Meryl Streep, the most nominated like actress of her generation. Like she's coming off of 5 Oscar nominations or something, or 4 mm-hmm. in the '80s, playing the absolute most vapid first lady ever. Like she's hilarious in this.
And then Lucas Haas gives that speech on the steps of the Capitol, and the speech is terrible.
It's a bad speech. Yeah, he's like, we should live in teepees.
Like Burton's just like anything that you any sort of sense of meaning that you might want to derive from this film. No,
yeah,
I'm not giving it
no
to
meaning.
You. No.
Other than like be nice to your grandma.
Right, of course.
That's about it. Yeah. It's like, you know, the one thing you can take from this is like grandma probably has the answers.
it was really fun to watch over again, and it was just so fun to see her over again. Again, I saw Mars Attacks in the theater, and
I saw it in theater as well.
Yeah.
This is one of my dad's favorite movies. He loves this movie.
Yeah, I said I was like, oh, that's the same woman from Beetlejuice. You know what I mean? And like I said, to that point, I hadn't seen any of the older films. And then he said, you go back and you see the life that led up to that, and it's really amazing. So as a film, I don't through these episodes I'm doing, I don't really worry too much about like, oh, is this like a great film to go out on? Because not every actor really gets the chance to decide that. And she kept working. She was in Fantasy Island, the rebooted Fantasy Island after Mars Attacks. I haven't seen any of that show. It came and went very quickly. But as I think of someone with her kind of I don't give a shit attitude that she had, I feel like she would look at this and say, this was a good one to go out on, because it has her Burton and her, she said in an interview, I think we were lovers in a past life. I mean, she took to him really quickly. And I think she probably appreciated the film's kind of just, yeah, whatever attitude.
You know, I actually did watch the reboot Fantasy Island with Malcolm McDowell, but I can't remember her in it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sorry. I was trying to think like, what, because it's Barry Sonnenfeld did it,
yeah,
coming off Adam's Family. I watched it with another one I watched with my dad, but I can't remember anything about this show.
It came and went so fast. I remember hearing about it.
I didn't even realize she was in it. You know, I think we watched, this was the late 90s was when if my family as a family watched a show, like a sci-fi fantasy show, you knew it was going to get canceled. I think we had like 10 shows in a row where we all decided this is our family show, and then it got canceled. And we were like, damn, we got to stop having family shows. But no, I agree. I think this is a great, it's not necessarily like a great capper in terms of like who she was as at her height in the 30s.
Sure.
But
sure.
Who she is as a person, I think it's a great capper. Because it really reflects who she was literally as an older woman who had that I don't care attitude, who had that like brassiness, who had that like I just want to do things that are interesting until I'm out of money and I'm dead. And I feel like she really got to do that with this role. And then, you know, on that line, her very last line is basically like, just make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah. That's right.
It's so deadpan the way she says it.
Oh,
too.
Man.
Like, the whole world has exploded, and she's just like, young lady, just don't let this happen again.
Yeah. I feel like had she lived, she would have just been in every Burton movie after this. Like,
yeah.
He would have just kept putting her in movies. I feel like
she was somewhere for her in Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, right. Big eyes or whatever. Like, she just would have shown up in one scene because I think she just was like, oh, this is my guy now. You know, this is a guy who appreciates me and I like this guy. So it was so fun to rewatch it. And it was great to check out all these films that I hadn't seen. I've said a bunch of times, one of the reasons I love doing the show that I do is because the guest points me in a direction and I get to check out movies that I would not normally go check out to see. I would not have seen Violent Saturday. I don't think I'd even heard of it until I looked it up and saw there was an old filmography. And now that I've seen, I'm like, God, that was a terrific movie. And same thing with Merrily We Go to Hell. I have that on Blu-ray now. You know, I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. So I was so
that Criterion Blu-ray is really great too.
The documentary on Dorothy Arznar is terrific and really, really good. So it was just great to revisit her career. And I really appreciate you selecting her to talk with me. And I really appreciate you coming on the show, Maria. It's always fun to talk to you.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept. And she's someone who straddled, like, to your point, so many, like, these early 30s films, then the TV stuff, the schlocky 50s stuff, the Tim Burton. It's like anything that you're a fan of, there's probably a Sylvia Sidney movie for you to watch. From any of those decades, from any of those genres, she's got you covered.
That's a great place to leave it. So again, Mariah, thank you so much for doing this. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I am Old Films Flickr pretty much everywhere. I'm not on Twitter as much these days. It's slowly dying. I'm trying to wean myself off of it, but I am on Blue Sky. And Instagram mostly. And then I have a Substack where on Fridays I write about films directed by women. Usually 3 to 4 new films and then 3 to 4 older films, that you can stream. And I think I've covered like 500 films directed by women so far on that newsletter. Wow. So there are thousands. So I will never run out. And there's always like tons of new ones every week. So I'm trying to like just help people, you know, find new directors to fall in love with. And I also write a little bit about silent films, depending on how, you know, I'm a freelance writer. So like I have a lot of terrible movies I'm usually reviewing. But when I have actual time to sit down and write about a good silent film, I try to do that as well. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Like I said, I wish anyone listening to this, somebody pitch me the films of Dorothy Arzner, because I've only seen two of her films at this point and they're both terrific. And she had a really interesting career. And so I would love to have an excuse to go back and watch her earlier films. Cause they're again, just the two I've seen.
He's got a great, great filmography. Some of them are hard to find though, which is unfortunate.
That was something else too about the Sylvia Sidney. Like some of them you had to really kind of work to track them down. Like Merrily We Go to Hell. Like, I mean, it's on Criterion, but like City Streets is only on DVD. It's not streaming anywhere.
Yeah.
So a lot of her stuff is on YouTube, luckily. It's a shame that, you know, as you realize, everybody, you can't trust streaming because these things are not there, or they used to be, and now they're not. You know,
older films are just harder and harder to find.
Yeah. If you can get a physical copy, get yourself a physical copy of something. So, again, I really appreciate you doing the show.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoy talking to you. So thanks everybody for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can find us on Twitter. Like Mariah, slowly fading. We're also on Blue Sky.
I guess it's called X.
I'm not calling it that. No. Forget that. At Fade Out Pod. It's also on Blue Sky. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big thanks to Monique D for her support of Fade Out. I really, really appreciate it. So thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.
Lawrence Norris, I hereby present to you the Congressional Medal of Honor, the highest decoration our nation can bestow.
Thank you, honey. But don't you dare let this happen again.